10 words that really launch this little piece there. Look back in anger, class, regionalism, and the new wave. And we see an image there of a poet, John Silkin, very much a man of the 20th century, 67 years of age when he passed away. And that's taken in Leeds, a wonderful, probably February time, snow across the base there, looking fairly mean, fairly moody, etc. And certainly not epitomising Oasis's line about don't look back in anger. The 1950s and the 1960s, in particular, are often described as a reaction to the past. We've already seen how Second World War is now beginning to fade into the depths of history and so on. We're seeing change. We saw last week how the BBC impacted in terms of its cultural content, and also how the advent of commercial television also was impacting society in general. And that's before we even start considering the notion of commercials and so on. But it's worth noting in particular that as far as this particular period is concerned, in the interwar period between World War I and the Second World War, Britain had an empire. There it is, in all its glory. The British knew their place in the world, and it was at the top. People knew their place in British society as well. Working classes would tend to defer, in general, to the higher classes. And the upper middle class and the upper class in general would provide role models to look up to. There would be a sense of high culture, classical music, literature. There would be a classic notion of the British being wonderful administrators. People were generally educated, if you went off to university, to run things and to look after, say, the whole range of the empire in which freedom, fraternity, federation, at the heart of the whole message, the sun never sets from Canada through Australia, through Africa, through India, and various parts in between. Rule Britannia was very much the message. We were quite clearly number one. And perhaps the most famous exponent of the British Empire was the man that we see there, Rudyard Kipling. He was born in Bombay in 1865, and he was born to an influential family. Amongst other things, possibly one of his most famous texts was The Jungle Book. He also wrote the Just So stories. And he wrote many influential poems that were sung or recited in the music halls. They were featured in prominent newspapers. And a lot of his poetry was actually learnt by rote in schools. In 1906, he published If. If actually tells a young man what he needs to be in order to be truly British. One of you, two of you, might recall it being used to underplay some of the BBC Olympic coverage. It regularly gets resuscitated when we have sporting events of national significance. It very much focuses in its analysis of the British people as being a noble people, a heroic people, a people that were fit for the responsibilities of life. Just listen to the following verses from If you're not familiar with the actual text. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you, but make an allowance for their doubting too, if you can wait and not be tired by waiting, or being lied about, don't deal in lies, or being hated, don't give way to hating, and yet don't look too good, nor talk too wise. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings, nor lose the common touch, if neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you, but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Almost a standard that's too hard to achieve, too hard to attain. This notion of actually being in the right place at the right time, acknowledging what needs to be done, the recipe for a perfect life, you might well say. But then, of course, the Great War happened. And before the Great War, we had a whole range of issues that occurred, and Kipling lost his faith. He lost his faith in the empire and a variety of other things. His son, John Kipling, died in the First World War. And if you compare what we've just heard in terms of if with a few lines from another of his poems that was actually written after the First World War, this is called The Children, you can see a very different voice of the poet. It's a very angry poem. It focuses on bad leadership, incompetent generals, and also the loss of a generation of heroes for no good reason. It goes as follows. They believed us and perished for it. Our statecraft, our learning delivered them bound to the pit and alive to the burning, whither they mirthfully hastened as jostling for honour. Not since her birth has our earth seen such worth loosed upon her. Nor was their agony brief, or once only imposed on them. The wounded, the war spent, the sick received no exemption. Being cured, they returned and endured and achieved our redemption. Hopeless themselves of relief till death, marvelling, closed on them. But who shall return us, the children? Now, just comparing those two particular aspects, if and the children, we see that this is not the Rudyard Kipling of the British Empire. It's an angry man who's lost his belief in what the Empire stands for. And the reason we're focusing a little bit on Rudyard Kipling is because at the end of the Second World War, when we thought that actually we were learning more aspects, well, actually, these sorts of ideas, this disillusionment with society, was becoming increasingly common. The Empire had been lost. Britain was rapidly descending into a second or even third-rate power. And deference between the classes had also been lost. After years of chaos and two world wars, the general people didn't believe any longer in the culture, abilities, and competencies of the upper classes. As early as 1946, the novelist Evelyn Waugh was able to state categorically that England as a great power is done for. The British Empire was on the verge of final collapse. In 1947, India went for independence, obviously fronted by Gandhi, and the empire still looked viable up to a proportion of time, but gradually one colony after another lowered the colours of the Union Jack flag and went it alone. So that from the 1940s through to the 1960s, Britain as a world power was in decline. As we saw, the Suez was clearly an impactful experience on that. And so we come up to the 60s, key sort of elements of what we got here. John Osborne is featured there on the left, an actor who also became a very notable playwright, and came up with the book Look Back in Anger, a play. And in his play, Look Back in Anger, one of the characters, Colonel Renfrew, looks back to Indian independence and remarks, I knew in my heart it was all over. Everything was gone. George Orwell wrote of his despair at the whole culture that Britishness was vanishing, that the empire was being thrown overboard. England was being reduced to a cold and unimportant little island. British character, British culture, British ceremony, British style all seemed under threat. As I said, the collapse didn't happen all at once. And in 1957, Britain still controlled or had a controlling interest in 45 countries. But by 1964, Ghana, Malaya, Cyprus, Nigeria, Sierra Leone, Tanganyika, Jamaica, Trinidad, Uganda, Kenya, and several other colonies were all granted independence. So one after another, all these colonies which were ruled over and effectively administered by the British Empire were going. The sun, in other words, had finally set over the British Empire. So let's ask that question, why? Well, some writers actually argue that America was intent on dismantling the European colonies, primarily in order to forward her own ideology of a world which was made up of a democratic, capitalist series of states where free trade, particularly American trade, could prosper. Others talked about a new sense of nationalism and national identity that was sweeping the world, with people insisting on governing their own affairs. Now, it's certainly there, but nationalist movements in the colonies were generally weak affairs. They were often more about the ambitions of indigenous leaders than real self-rule. Some of it, admittedly, was to do with the war, that disillusionment that I've already referred to. The empire, effectively, had been made up of a patchwork of delicately balanced relationships. And the demands of war, forced economic development, milking the colonies for all that they were worth, and the formation of monopolies, food-growing campaigns that didn't benefit the locals, and enforced austerity would all alienate local colonies and local allies. For Britain itself, the breaking up of the empire was a relatively quiet affair. There were only two colonies that actually rebelled, Palestine and Aden. British politicians themselves didn't seem to have the will to keep it all together. We looked at Harold Macmillan last week. You never had it so good. He was no admirer of the past, and he was looking forward to a progressive future. He was looking forward to strong relations with both Europe and the United States. And this whole notion of the empire itself felt very old-fashioned. You know, a time that had long since gone, that had vanished from what was current, what was modern, and so on. Ultimately, the dismantling of the empire was an act of political realism. The pace itself was arguably too fast. It was a bit like knocking down a house of cards. For instance, there are actually estimates that Nigeria needed 25 years to be ready for self-rule. Basically, she was given one. So again, from 25 years to prepare itself to actually get into a position where it could actually govern itself, suddenly you have to instantly get the thing sorted within a year. And there were some awful results. There were civil wars that took place in former colonies, military takeovers. But inevitably, the momentum of independence, self-rule, took on a life of its own. Inevitably, intellectuals were worried about the impact that this whole element would have on British culture. At first, no one else seemed too worried about the whole aspect, though, and life in Britain went on as before. Britain continued to have special relationships within the Commonwealth. Commonwealth primarily a loose collection of ex-colonial nations. There's an annual Commonwealth Day. There were, of course, the Commonwealth Games. And there were royal visits. Some historians have argued that actually it's the royal family, and in particular Queen Elizabeth, that effectively managed to be the glue that kept the kind of bond of the Commonwealth together. And still do, obviously. The Commonwealth itself was designed to ease this transition from being ruled and governed by Britain to being self-independent countries. This idea of the Commonwealth representing a family of peoples with a shared history working together for peace and prosperity emerged. Ultimately, you could cynically say that was a painkiller to cover up the loss, saying, well, we've lost this, but we're still kind of together, we're still friends, aren't we? This idea of Commonwealth appeased certainly the right-wing thinkers in Britain, because it still suggested that Britain was still a power, an influential power, in the post-war world. It was also greeted with delight by various left-wing ideologies, because there was this notion that we were still helping the colonies along. So it was generally seen as a reasonably satisfactory solution to actually deal with the challenges that were faced there. However, there was still this sense that the Second World War in particular had turned British society upside down, and Britain itself needed to become a different sort of society with a new culture and new university-trained leaders and experts, many of whom would come up from middle classes via the new social sciences, political science, economics, sociology, to effectively manage society and so on. And as with all new societies, as well as new scientists, as well as new mechanics, engineers, and so on, you need new artists. The humanities provide the inspiration which enable people to look to the future and be inspired. Many of the educated young folk who were off to university, John Osborne being an example there, they would reject the high art of the past. They argued that no one wanted to hear about Britain before the wars. They didn't want to watch upper-class plays and farces. They weren't interested in reading Rudyard Kipling's stories of India and empire, or indeed Anthony Trollope on the ups and downs of upper-class families. Nobody really had time for classical music, or indeed the opera. But there is this pause in the sort of mid to late 1950s, which suggested there was a gap which needed to be filled. Where were the post-war writers and artists coming from who were going to redefine this notion of Britishness? Well, there's one. Kingsley Amis, often regarded as the first writer to emerge, and indeed, although he rejected this label, he was often referred to as the first angry young man. Somebody who effectively wanted to make a point about society and forget the past and look forward to a new, modernised image of being British. Amis was middle class. He was also upwardly mobile. He made it to Oxford and then became a lecturer at Swansea, finally settling, not too far away from here, in Hull. He was a jazz enthusiast, and he read and sometimes wrote such new forms of science fiction. In 1954, he published his first comic novel. It was entitled Lucky Jim. The main character in Lucky Jim, obviously named Jim, was a medieval lecturer at a northern university who didn't have any respect for his elders. He didn't have any respect for past traditions or for his own subject, which the only reason he chose was because it had the easiest exams, and he was, in other words, a normal middle-class bloke. He was interested in jazz, he was interested in beer, he was interested in girls. Anything more difficult than that made him shudder. He's also fairly anti any foreign ideas as well. Lucky Jim was a controversial book. It reflected the new world of the middle classes, it reflected the welfare state, it reflected the educational period of the time. In other words, young people were being churned out of universities with degrees, but they didn't have any cultural education. You got a degree to get a job, not an education. In other words, this whole notion of going to university to reflect and pontificate, have time to consider studies, was kind of being relegated to the notion of saying, no, you go to university simply to be another stepping stone to get a job, etc. Sadly, something which still permeates society today, I think. Lucky Jim itself reflected a world in which the new generation of young people, this incorporates teenagers as well, of course, had no manners, no morals, and they really didn't have much interest in anything except consumerism. So what was Amis actually doing in terms of this notion of, again, that radical new writer? Well, he's attacking what he would refer to as the pretentious intellectualism of the past. Lucky Jim was a work of vandalism, cultural vandalism at least. It's not particularly aesthetic, it's not politically aware, it's not thoughtful, but what it is quite clearly a rejection of the past. Anything that kind of related to the pre-World War II days, etc., of the upper classes, etc., was to be scorned or rejected or effectively pushed to one side and junked. In English drama, certainly, and British drama as well, one of the most successful writers pre-World War II was Terence Rattigan. Clearly upper class, as you can tell by having a cigarette holder to actually smoke his cigarette. He was born in 1911, and his first big success came in 1936 when he was 25. It was a play called French Without Tears. It was about young diplomats. Other well-known Rattigan plays include The Browning Version, The Winslow Boy, and in 1953, The Prince and the Showgirl, which was filmed in Hollywood with Laurence Olivier and Marilyn Monroe in the leading roles. Rattigan's work was quite clearly conservative. It was well-crafted, but it was aimed at the middle-class theatre-goers. This isn't the musical. This is people who go to the theatre, to be seen to go to the theatre, very much as a middle-class occupation. Rattigan's work is full of clever insights into the class system and the subtleties of British society, you and non-you. But then suddenly, at the height of his career, the world changed. No one wanted this sort of drama anymore. It was seen as old-fashioned. And in 1954, the English Stage Company formed with the aim, quite explicitly, of producing plays by new writers. The English Stage Company, if you haven't heard of it, is fairly important. It produced a fair number of famous actors of the day, who you may have heard of. Stephen Burkhoff, Glenda Jackson, Alan Bates, all were graduates of the English Stage Company. And they took their residence into the Palace Court Theatre. The first couple of productions had no particular impact, so they were looking for something special to really kind of get a resonance with the public and so on. And they chose a play by the aforementioned John Osborne. This particular play, Look Back in Anger, is considered something of a milestone in British theatre. Osborne was actually paid £25 for the actual play itself, which, to an out-of-work actor living on a houseboat, as he was at the time, was probably quite a nice insight, and probably the equivalent of about £2,500, maybe a little more, maybe £5,000 in contemporary times. Look Back in Anger, and again we'll have a look at this, quite literally, in seminars, took place in a small flat somewhere in the Midlands. The protagonist, Jimmy Porter, is young, played there by Richard Burton. He didn't have any particular beliefs in either religion or politics. He didn't believe that there was really anything worth fighting for in terms of queen or country. He was fairly self-evidently promiscuous. And again, in general, exhibits characters which can best be summed up in the words, he was bored, he was frustrated with the world, and he felt there was a huge sense of loss. It was very much a nihilistic view of looking at society. What's the point? Why should we just go on? What is, you know, why should we work through this? Now, it's fair to say that not everyone liked Look Back in Anger, but a critic called Kenneth Tynan, who was working for The Observer at the time, did, and made a great point of saying it was a new stage in more ways than one for British theatre to develop. And the play itself was a popular hit. It was made into a television play by November, and literary and theatre reviewers started to describe a whole generation of young writers as the angry young men. You know, more than Kingsley Amis, John Osborne, and others working through that. And this new wave of middle and working class writers included Alan Sillitoe, Kingsley Amis, John Osborne, John Brain. In other words, writers who would write about ordinary people. Not the kind of class system, not the kind of things that we actually had at the start of the century, but ordinary blokes and challenges that you'd find in everyday working class Britain. Conformity was seen as out of fashion, but anger was in. Terence Rattigan was torn apart by new theatre critics like Kenneth Tynan, and eventually he got so fed up with the whole system that he headed off, unloved, to live out his life in Bermuda. So, were the new writers offering a whole new image of the world that we were providing? There we have an image of the classic sort of post-war British scenario. Northern town, northern scenario is still a very dull, grey, unfortunate choice of activities. Well, most ordinary people lived in the 1950s pretty much as they'd always lived. They worked hard, they had little money, and they lived in the shoddy Victorian housing of the industrial towns in the provinces. There'd be a Birmingham, the Nottinghams, the Lincolns, and so on. The landscape was generally one of outside toilets. There was rubbish everywhere, gas works were present, factory hooters were going, and there was spam and toast for tea. At the same time, as we saw at the start of this module, the government was also pouring money into new estates. But again, there was never enough housing to go around. It's estimated that about 7 million people lived below the poverty line, while 90% of the population owned less than 4% of the wealth. Now, in the post-war years, as we've also looked at, the large-scale impact of social sciences from America brought a new interest in poverty. There was a lot of research in terms of how the poor lived. This was often driven by market research and mass marketing, wanting to find out how people actually voted, how teenagers spent their money, and how did you sell a new washing powder to the mothers. These social science courses, which opened up at universities across the country, attracted lower middle class and working class students, mostly men and mostly Labour supporters. And this was the background of the people who wrote the new wave novels and plays, several of which, as we've said, were turned into films. In 1957, Richard Hoggart wrote that, The Uses of Literacy. This was an examination of working class culture by a working class man. Hoggart was typical of the upwardly mobile. He had a scholarship to grammar school, so he successfully passed his 11 plus, he moved into grammar school. He then went off to university, he then taught in adult education. And the working class industrial landscape that Hoggart describes is full of hardship, poverty and strained family relationships. There was a traditional working class life that he actually saw as being comprised of communities. Communities that were being destroyed by affluence and education because the young would move away. There was a culture that effectively meant that once you actually got your education, why would you hang around in the drabness of your working class surroundings? You'd move off. The pub life would actually give way to mass media. And Hoggart actually argued that whilst education could bring freedom, it was a false freedom. It was a freedom that actually destroyed what was important about being working class. It undermined decency. And this is where we start getting that critical complaint about the American culture. He attacked consumerism as a corrupt message. It was cheap, it was sensationalist entertainment which was destroying taste. Basically, it was barbaric and it was meaningless. The loss of centuries of music hall culture and ballads that people knew by heart, shared culture and history, was all actually being forgotten and replaced by jukeboxes and throwaway American imports. Effectively, he argued, the young people of Britain were giving up their heritage and replacing it by buying it into a vague dream, a dream which amounted to a few narrow consumerist elements, a fashion, a style, and it left them empty, without aims or ambitions. Wouldn't we do much better at cricket if we could actually get back to playing in the streets again? Would that get back to the root of the problem?
Absolutely.
In other words, the book itself deals with a nostalgia. And this is a line that often comes through, that as a country, we are a people who stagger backwards into the future, looking longingly at the past. It's a nostalgia for a wartime north of England, in particular, a working class community, a sense of neighbourhood that's rapidly vanishing. And it's that form that many of the New Wave writers actually aimed to depict. The regions, the provinces, the terraced houses around the factories, communities that were still British. And the literature of the New Wave could be seen ultimately as being anti-American and anti-shallow modern mass culture. The authors were interested in the old world of the industrial working class. Books that would focus on social issues, working class poverty, aggressive attitudes towards sex and women, crime, abortion, homelessness, unhappy marriages. A number of those New Wave books were turned into films, and they're sometimes called kitchen sink dramas, because they were dramas and they were based around the kitchen, as in kitchen sink dramas. Some of the areas that came through was Stan Barstow's A Kind of Loving, 1962, Saturday Night and Sunday Morning, Taste of Honey, Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. You can all access them on YouTube. There's our lines from that point of view. All of them had a couple of key things in common. They were predominantly monochrome, black and white. The actors had provincial accents, and they also had very similar plots. The protagonists would be working class. They'd be stifled by the working class culture of the North. They'd be dissatisfied, they'd be threatened by change, and they certainly wouldn't be heroic. The landscape would be seen as bleak. It would have a lack of direction and identity, and the plot primarily would be about beer, brawls, failed relationships, and deprivation. Not too dissimilar from your average EastEnders episode. Again, there's a whole line that comes through with that. The characters themselves would often be on good wages, or they'd be products of the welfare state. But their lives themselves would be meaningless and they'd be spiritually empty. So, is this all there is? Is there nothing more? Is this what we've come to? And in A Kind of Loving, you can see there, Stan Barstow's play The Man Got His Girlfriend Pregnant. He married her, but he didn't love her. In Billy Liar by Keith Waterhouse, a nasty young man treats everyone and everything with contempt. He keeps planning to leave, but finally it's his girlfriend, played by Julie Christie, who actually gets on the train to London and a new life. All of these films, as I say, were very similar. But they weren't very successful at the box office. So what's he doing talking about them in 2017? Well, the people who actually watched these films weren't the working class. The audiences for these films tended to be young, middle class, and educated. So there was a sense of influence that was coming to the fore there. But because they were so similar in terms of plot, in terms of the unremitting negativity that they were portraying of life and so on, the demand for the films themselves became quickly exhausted. In other words, familiarity bred lack of interest. Although it's fair to say that they did survive for a while, and the original Tony Warren concept for Coronation Street was very much based on these kitchen sink dramas. So they emerged or re-emerged within the televisual landscape. Again, one of the thoughts is that why they weren't popular was because how could they possibly compete with the glamour, the glitz, the gloss of the Hollywood Dream Factory? Why would you want to actually go to the movies to see dramatic recreations of a life that effectively you're trying to escape from, where you'd much rather leap into an escapist dream world of fantasy and so on? Private Eye actually ran a spoof at the time, which was a novel by Stan Blister, as opposed to Stan Barstow, called A Waste of Living. This new wave, then, didn't succeed in halting the collapse of the British film industry, which by that stage, after having had various peaks and troughs through the whole sequence, was pretty much restricted to the Ealing comedies and a number of other sort of key areas. Hammer had not really entered into the frame as yet. And the novels that actually the movies were based on, probably, if you reread them from a contemporary's perspective, aren't really as good as people thought they were at the time. They were not necessarily at the same level of, say, the 19th century, the works of Trollope, Dickens, and so on. The films didn't produce any great British film directors as such, although there were a number of folk like Lindsay Anderson who emerged from the sequence. But there certainly wasn't the equivalent to the Italian director Federico Fellini, who effectively celebrated again the working class and so on. And did they actually solve any social problems? Nope. But what they did seem to do was create an idea of the North that may or may not be true. It's grim up north, north of Watford. And as those of you who actually are born north of that halcyon line at Watford will appreciate, with that, the flat caps, the ferrets down the trousers, and so on, what is being North? It's a stereotype. Movies actually rejected intellectuals and culture for culture's sake. It certainly, and they collectively, rejected American materialism. The heroes themselves, anti-heroes, looked down on everyone. They resented everything. They bullied women, and they rejected everything except apathy. They couldn't care less. Now, you could say that's reflecting, again, the British culture at the time. It's providing other insight into British culture and so on. What's particularly interesting, though, about this whole nostalgia for the past, those working-class factories and northern towns, Nottingham, Lincoln, Newark, and so on, was clearly this notion that somehow we are dealing with this loss of something, this sense of loss, the sense of working-class values, that ownership, that collective ownership, and so on, which, in the main, was predominantly white and lower working-class and centred around the factory and so on. And somehow, in terms of disappearing, we actually were changing. Because in those depressing working class environments, you might have found a variety of artists and young men going off to art college, like those two fine folk, etc. One of whom you may recognise as being John Lennon. And again, maybe not. Would you actually find the whole notion of where these people were emerging, the David Bowies, the John Lennons and so on, without these kind of roots that were being developed within the whole field? In other words, there were also a range of folk who just couldn't connect to the working class system, and, rather like Billy Liar's Girlfriend, written about by Keith Waterhouse, effectively got on a train and left. Again, we'll be looking at what happens to these people in a later lecture. But I finally want to come back to Rudyard Kipling's poem, which is where effectively we came in. If, and the movie by Lindsay Anderson, which stars Malcolm McDowell up there. He killed Captain Kirk. He did, but there you are. He's up there shooting various other things and so on. Also, it's the star in Clockwork Orange, which again was a movie which created a whole range of issues in the 1970s. Kipling's poem that we kicked off with was designed to inspire the young man to run an empire, pre-World War I and so on. If in 1968 was generally regarded as the last of the new wave movies, it deliberately focused on that Kipling title. It was set in a British public school and it followed a group of sixth formers. Now, these are the same young men in the same public school as Kipling was writing about, but it's 1968. And as we'll go on to see in subsequent weeks, this is where the counterculture begins to go into full flow. At the end of the film on open day, the screenshot that you actually got there, effectively, is where the sixth formers get hold of automatic weapons and attack the school. What, the head of Bowling for Columbine, etc.?
Yes, exactly.
We did before the Americans actually started shooting people down. The headmaster was actually shot in the head, and the whole thing was very much a tirade against the establishment, against old values and culture. Values which were seen at this time as having no place in the modern world. However, nobody was really quite sure about what values, if any, was replacing them. And we'll talk more about that and subsequent activities that are going on in the next 168 hours. Thanks for your time.